Jonathan Barnes, read by Annika Wills. At this hour of the day, thinks Mrs. Polly Jackson as she walks into the little sitting room of what is shortly to become her former home, there is something quietly beautiful about the quality of the light, something fragile, slender, something fraught with subtle promise. It is early, a little after dawn, and Polly, still clad in her dressing gown, holds in her left hand a mug of herbal tea and is upon all sides surrounded by cardboard boxes. Stacked against the walls, taking up almost all available space, each one of them, outwardly identical, is a parcel of memories, a capsule of the past. So it is early then, but it is also late. It is very late. Just at the end of her time in this place, the last day and final hours. The removal men will, she thinks, by now already be stirring, rising from their beds, stepping into showers and shrugging on overalls, tapping into sat-navs the details of what has, for almost 20 years, been the Jackson sanctuary, but which to them, to the men who are set to arrive at 8 o'clock sharp, will just be another job. One in a line of near-identical engagements. At the thought of these people and of their neat professional disinterest, Polly feels a surge of what she knows to be wholly unfair anger. She chides herself and sips her tea whilst she waits for the emotion to abate. She gazes mournfully at those receptacles into which so many decades of their lives have been packed. Her husband is still sleeping, and she finds herself glad of the opportunity for a few moments alone, for a tiny space in this most hectic of days, in which she can mark the occasion in her own fashion. She stands, and she remembers, and she finds in the moment a stillness that she had never discovered as a younger woman, but in the cultivation of which she has, in recent years, taken considerable pleasure. But then the instant is lost and she exhales, feeling as she does so the onset of doubt. She is beset by the sudden suspicion that she's making a mistake, that they should never have decided to leave this beautiful place, that they should grow old here together, nestled in their memories, surrounded by the comfort of the familiar, not travel halfway across the country to a town where they know nobody but family, and where she surmises they might be seen as aberrations, incomers, strangers, to be marvelled at or shunned. She feels as though she should run next door, wake the man she married, and inform him, that they shall not be moving, that the workers in their vans will have to be turned around, that even now it isn't too late to call the whole thing off. But she waits. She breathes. Finishing the last of her tea, she sets down the mug. Then, without quite knowing why, to allow herself perhaps a further moment in which to recalibrate her thoughts, she picks up the nearest of the boxes and brings it over to the sofa, which is still in its proper place, albeit now covered in plastic for protection. The box opens easily, and within there are, as she knows that there will be, fragments of her history. 2 vases, inherited from her mother, carefully bound in newspaper, a money box made from clay by a favourite nephew, a carriage clock, and a set of awful figurines which she would have thrown out years ago had they not been a gift from her other half. She smiles at the gaucheness of the present, its well-intentioned hideousness. And then there is something else, something wholly unexpected, a thing that she has not seen, has not even thought of for years, an artifact which has no business being here now, an emissary from that strangest of all times in her life. It is a long green feather. It's very beautiful, and it is, quite palpably, not of this earth. She frowns, at first not quite making sense of the oddness of the sight, its sheer impossibility. She reaches out and her fingers touch the soft down of the thing, and then all at once she is transported into the past, or future, or what might well be some mad eternal present, back to that great churning wilderness which exists outside of time and space. Polly, younger now, and filled with an innocence that is almost emblematic of the decade in which she has lived her formative years, steps from her bedroom into that mysterious craft, which is, at the current time, her home, and into a corridor which is far darker than that to which she is accustomed. Her eyes are damp and ringed with red, her cheeks still wet with tears. Duchess! She looks up to find a few paces ahead of her a strikingly handsome young man dressed in a naval uniform. The swagger of his unexamined machismo offset intriguingly by flashes of tenderness and guileless intuition. He smiles at the sight of her, although Polly notices that the expression is edged with sadness and that his eyes show evidence also of recent sorrow.
You too, he says, and she nods.
I couldn't sleep. The nascent conversation falters for a moment and they look at one another, something urgent crackling between them which somehow does not seem to complicate that childish sense of companionship which has characterised their relations to date.
Paul?
Yes?
This is going to sound wild, but did you...
She's smiling too now at his slight discomfort. She prompts him. Did I what?
Did you just have a bad dream? I mean, a real cracker of a nightmare?
The smile fades. I did. Yes. I think amongst the worst I've ever had. The gaze between them intensifies. When I woke, Ben, I was crying without quite knowing why, as if suddenly all I could feel was the most horrible sort of sadness.
Ben looks as if he's about to agree.
You too?
Yeah. Yes, I'm in along those lines.
Ben wipes self-consciously at his eyes with the back of his hand.
So what's going on with all this, then?
He gestures to the dim, roundled walls that surround them.
The TARDIS ain't usually so dark.
No, it's not. And don't you think there's a sort of feeling as well that we're travelling just a bit too fast?
Oh,
no, I wouldn't know about that.
Well, if I know anything, it's ships, and this one seems to me to be just on the edge of getting out of control.
The Doctor... Polly begins, but Ben, seemingly comforted by the opportunity for action over debate, raises a commanding hand.
Yeah, that crazy old man ought to know. Shall we see if we can find him?
Yes, come on, let's do that. And they turn and walk away down the shadowy corridor towards the direction of the control room. They walk close to each other for comfort, and there are a couple of seconds in which it looks as though they might even hold hands, although, in the end, the time for this not yet quite having arrived, they do not. The console room, the stark heart of the machine, is, when they reach it, no more brightly lit than the rest of the craft. Often the glare of it, its white heat, and almost aggressive futurism, comes close to being too much for Polly, even she, the very spirit of modernity. Yet, seeing it like this, reduced to shadow, she feels as though something important has been lost, something hopeful, extinguished. In the centre of the room, beside the console itself, his bird-like hands resting upon its shining metal surface, in the manner of some elderly rural parson leaning on a silver lectern, stands the man who has swept them away into this strange existence. He who is known as the Doctor. Not, of course, and this Polly has only lately begun to understand, that he is truly a man at all. Lost in thought, the Doctor does not seem to have noticed their arrival. He seems meditative, and Polly considers, with a pang of dismay, visibly frail. She and the sailor trade glances, uncertain now that they are here as to whether or not they should intrude upon their new friend's solitude. In the end, it is Ben who clears his throat and says,
Doctor,
The doctor looks up, and Polly thinks, he knew we were here. Of course he knew.
Children, whatever are you doing abroad at this hour? Hmm? By rights, you ought to be abed.
It was... Ben stops, frowns. Doctor, there were bad dreams.
Hmm?
The doctor turns to face them now. That troubling frailty which Polly had noted mere moments before, already receding, to be replaced by some greater spirit of curiosity and adventure.
A nightmare, was it, child? A sense of some great, ineffable sadness? Of some unbelievable, that is to say, inexpressible tragedy? As though something were being lost which can never be regained?
Yes, Polly says. Yes, that's exactly right. Doctor, Ben is patiently, carefully working things out.
Doctor, how can you know that?
The old man grins, and Polly sees, with some surprise, that it is the smile of a very much younger person.
Because, my dear Mr. Jackson, I too had that self-same dream.
Polly is about to ask for an explanation, when both without warning and also somehow inevitably, the room seems to lurch violently downwards, and all three of them are flung about and forced to clutch frantically for support. A scene which had hitherto been one of minatory stillness is now one of urgency and kineticism. They plummet down deep into the vortex. Polly hears a shrill cry of exhilarated panic, which it takes her a while to recognise as her own. And then, after that, everything is speed and movement and descent. By the time that it ends, several minutes later, when what passes for equilibrium in the TARDIS has been restored, Polly becomes aware of two things. Firstly, that Ben's hand is holding hers, albeit on the necessary pretext of helping her to her feet. Secondly, that the doctor is already up and edging towards the door, seemingly spryer than before, as if even this small drama has, at least for now, started to revivify him. As soon as Polly is standing, Ben lets her hand go free. The old man is talking, ostensibly to his two young guests, but in actuality, Polly thinks, either to himself or to the ship itself.
Something was falling. Something falling through time and through space. Something which I do believe has no business existing. The ship was caught up in its slipstream.
Yes.
Slipstream. That's all as may be, Doctor, says Ben.
But where are we now?
That felt a lot more like a crash to me than a landing. Nonsense, my boy, nonsense. Simply a case of one object being caught up in the descent of another. As to where we are, I have suspicions, but as yet no firm data. Shall we see for ourselves? Yes, I never could resist the opportunity to explore.
He smiles that impish young man smile again, and without waiting for a reply, he presses the lever, which opens the door and strides out into the unknown. Ben is looking at Polly with candid disbelief.
Crazy! He's crazy! Come on, Polly says. We have to make sure he doesn't get himself into any mischief.
She walks away to follow the doctor, realizing somehow as she does so that, no matter the nature of the danger therein, the handsome sailor shall always follow. As Polly steps out of the TARDIS and into whatever realm lies beyond, as she moves from one state of being into another, she feels a sensation which, in years to come, she will often miss with a bone-deep ache, of giddy discovery and of impossible delight at the new, of the certainty that she and Ben are amongst a vanishingly small number of their species to have been granted such a privilege in the whole of human history. She steps onto a dark, level plain. The doctor is standing a few feet ahead of her, his back turned. The sky is a dim yet evidently extraterrestrial shade of purple. Far away, at the tip of the horizon, are the peaks of some terrifyingly vertiginous mountain range. Underfoot is bright, dense, granular dust, made of a colour which she's never seen before, will never see again, and which she will be able to recollect only fleetingly at moments of high emotion. In the sky circle birds of a kind undreamt of, even in the wildest speculations of crazed ornithologists. Their cries, paradoxically, melodious shrieks which form savage harmonies. The air is too close, thick and soupy, and the gravity of the place seems heavier and more insistent than that to which she is used, making her movement slow and overly careful. It is, she thinks, like I'm still asleep, and that this, all this, is my dream. As she stands at the edge of this new world, drinking in its rich and vivid peculiarities, Ben Jackson saunters past her, looking as if he might at any moment start to whistle jauntily. "Blimey," he says, casting a glance at their surroundings, before permitting his gaze to land, with faux insouciance, upon Polly herself.
"This is an odd one, and no mistake," he grins and raises his voice. "Doctor?"
The old man gives no sign that he has heard, but remains still and silent, his back against them.
"Hey, doctor!"
Still nothing.
"Come on, Duchess," Ben grins again. "Let's find out where we are."
Even when they reach the old man, he does not at first acknowledge them. Rather, he is staring into the distance, in the direction of those faraway peaks, his eyes inquisitive.
"Hey, doctor,"
Ben says, when they're by his side.
"Where are we now?"
So long does the traveller take to respond that Polly begins to wonder if he's heard them at all. Then,
"I've deduced our location from the position of the stars, but I doubt that the name of the place would be of the slightest significance to you at all, my boy. Dependent, of course, upon your knowledge of the outer and rarely visited quadrant of the Wildean galaxy." "No." "Well, it would still be good to know." "It is, my boy, of no importance, no importance whatsoever."
The doctor hurries over his words to such a degree that Polly suspects he does not himself know the name, or, she thinks, even the proximate location of this place.
"Now," the old man says, "can you see what I can see?"
"Depends," says Abel Seaman Jackson, "on what it is you're talking about."
"Look there, far in the distance, that thin red plume of smoke."
Polly peers and strains in the direction of the doctor's gaze, and she sees that he is right. There is something, just as the old man said, far in the distance, a rising column.
"What is it, Doctor?"
"Whatever it was that was falling through the vortex has landed here. A landing, a less humble man than I, might feel compelled to add, which was considerably bumpier than our own. That smoke is our only indication of the site of the crash."
"Looks bad," Ben says.
"Crew might be injured, or worse." "Crew, my boy? You are assuming, I fancy, that it is some manner of craft or vessel."
"Yeah. Well, what else could it be?"
"What indeed, my boy, what indeed?"
"So what do we do?"
"We try to help, yes, if we can."
"Doctor,"
Polly says,
"it's miles away. It'll take us hours on foot."
And she thinks, despite the energy that this little adventure has granted you, you still seem worryingly frail. A hike into the mountains, well, a hike like that could kill you.
"Do not concern yourself, my child," says the doctor,
though Polly has spoken none of this aloud.
"I have a fancy that we shall ourselves be brought to..."
He does not even finish his sentence, for a slither of a second later, and with a curious rushing sound, as of that experienced by divers coming up for air, they are all three transported from their current position and into some quite different place. Mountains now, peaks and valleys on all sides, rocks and dust, the thin, clear scents of high places, and smoke, strange crimson smoke. It is quite clear what has happened, but the doctor, perhaps from habit, explains it all the same.
"As I thought, yes. Telekinetic transportation honed to a remarkable degree. We've been moved, miles and miles in an instant, all by the power of thought."
"Whose thought?" Ben asks.
"Come with me," the doctor says, "and it is my strong suspicion that I shall shortly be able to introduce you."
Wordlessly now, as if knowing what to do from instinct alone, the trio follow the smoke to its source, close by, at the heart of the mountain. It is a shallow crater, around which smoke has now begun to clear. They draw closer until they stand near to the edge and look down. There is an outline visible below, not, as Ben had suggested, of any sort of spaceship or vessel or device, but rather a silhouette of something that is almost, but not quite, human. It is the figure of a man. Eyes tight shut, he is tall and classically handsome, muscular beneath his robes of pale cream. He is also quite wonderfully in possession of a pair of great wings, the feathers of which are all of the most astonishingly vivid green.
Doctor, Polly says, an angel. It's an angel.
The old man frowns. Indeed, he almost pouts. Angel? What nonsense, child! Ha! Dear me, but in all my many years I never heard tell of such foolishness.
She's right, Doctor, says Ben stoutly. That's what he is, plain as a pikestaff. I mean, I was wrong about it being some sort of spaceship that dragged us here, but now we can see why. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it?
Whatever he is most certainly no angel. No, no, no. That's simply how he appears to your limited imaginations.
Actually, Doctor, exactly who he is or isn't, that's not what's important now, says Ben. What's important is whether that geezer's hurt and if we can help him.
Quite so, my boy.
The travellers step even further forward towards the precipice of that small crater.
Doctor,
Ben says again, striving as ever to be practical amongst all this heady surrealism. Is he still alive?
Who can say, my boy, who can say? Why, the physiognomy of such a being...
The doctor leaves his sentence unfinished, and no one else dares speak, for now the angel's eyes have opened, and Polly sees that they are of the same vibrant emerald as the feathers of his wings. Then the being itself is speaking, and his voice is all around, and it's in their heads, and it is deep and wise and ancient.
I was... falling.
Indeed you were, says the doctor. Tumbling, hmm? Tumbling through the vortex?
I have been falling for almost as long as I can remember. Through time and space and reality itself. And as I lie here, I am falling elsewhere. Falling forever through the stuff of history.
You must hail from some remarkable species to thrive as you.
Oh, but you know precisely from what species it is that I hail.
Hmm? What do you mean by that, my dear fellow?
Only this, that I am exactly what I appear to be.
Ah, but that's quite impossible. Those are legends... Those are wild myths.
And yet, here I lie, the last of my kind. As one day, so shall you be of yours.
If the doctor is troubled by the angel's words, he masks it, seeking recourse in that brand of English dottiness which Polly had seen him use before, both to place his friends at ease and to persuade his enemies to underestimate his considerable powers.
These notions, my dear sir, are fantastical ones. Yes, indeed they are. Quite fantastical.
Ben speaks up, his every syllable filled with decency. Are you hurt? Are you all right? Can we help you? Polly says,
I think we dreamed of you earlier, of your long, long fall.
You...
The angel breathes in, an action that seems to cause him some pain.
You are human, I think.
Of course we are, says the sailor.
Then the dreams. Yes, yours were ever a sensitive people. Such emotive bleed is possible.
Hear that, Duchess, Ben asks. Turns out I'm sensitive.
And yet...
The angel murmurs.
Your lives are such fleeting things. Tiny, fragile baubles. Flakes of snow that turn to nothing in the heat of the noonday sun.
Well, that's as maybe, says Ben. Maybe they are short.
Maybe too flipping short, but we like to try, you know, to make the most of them.
The angel smiles. This too seems to form the source of no small discomfort.
I am falling,
he says again.
But you too are falling, each in your own ways. If I have learned anything in the long millennia of my punishment, it is this, that we are all who are living, in a state of perpetual descent.
If you say so, Chief.
There are moments in all our lives, no matter how long or how brief they may be, when you have to fight no longer and permit gravity to claim you. Ben Jackson, the time is coming soon when you must fight your emotion no longer, for to do so makes you weak, and not, as you now believe, more strong.
Ben frowns. How did you know my name? The doctor interjects, waving a hand.
I would surmise a natural telepathic ability, namely, a trick.
The angel silences the doctor with his gaze.
You, Mrs. Polly Jackson.
At the angel's words, she thinks, or rather, she tells herself, that he cannot be so very infallible if he has her surname confused with that of the sailor by her side, although, perhaps, she senses even then the natural justice of his identification.
You too must accept the fall. Cling not to a past that has in truth already slipped away.
What do you... forgive me, but what do you mean?
From your perspective, these things have yet to occur. But you shall understand me when they do. And as for you, Doctor, little runaway, little thief.
The old man adopts a bullish stance, and at the sight of his pugnacious profile, Polly is reminded of the fire that he showed in London against Wotan and those machines which had sought only power and control.
You seem remarkably well informed, sir.
My descent has shown me many things. That which has been, that which shall be, and I have seen you, Doctor, many times and in many guises. I see you now, holding on, clinging to this old body, as does a drowning mariner to driftwood, gripping too tightly to your nearly spent life. There is so much for you that is still to come. You must, you know that you must allow yourself to change.
I...
The doctor speaks no more than this, before, in a gesture of which Polly would until that moment have thought him quite incapable, he casts his eyes almost meekly towards the ground.
The snow is waiting for you. For you and for that essential transformation.
The doctor looks up, filled, Polly thinks, with new resolve.
You might be correct, sir. Yes, indeed you might be. But my future is my own affair. Now, more pertinently, is there nothing we can do to free you from your current and most unenviable predicament?
You know that there is,
says the angel.
And that is why we have met here at this time and in this place. I would be free of this endless existence. Or rather, I would fall still further out of this place and into some unconscious plane.
And how might such a thing be done?
You know how. Search your memories and search your heart. My race was all but lost when yours first stumbled from the mire. By the time that you walked on hind legs, we had passed almost wholly into myth. And yet, something of us survived. in stories and legends, in parables and charms. And you remember now, Doctor, in riddles told to children after dark.
The Doctor peers down at the angel.
I had thought that merely a nursery rhyme.
An echo through time.
Doctor, asks Ben, what's he on about?
Something, my boy, from long ago. Words from a time when I was, in relative terms, younger even than you are now.
What words?
Words of something almost like poetry, which, until today, I had believed to have been of no particular significance at all.
The pattern,
says the angel.
You will, Doctor, as you grow older, come to see that the pattern is all around us, and that all things are connected and as one. Please, I pray you, speak those words and set me free. Let me fall further and deeper now into oblivion at last.
For a long time, the Doctor says nothing at all. Polly observes him closely, not daring to speak, watching his sometimes rather theatrical eccentricity fall incrementally away and leaving in its place a look of cold resolve. The old man closes his eyes and seems to summon up a half-buried memory, like a boy striving to recollect some prayer or poem learned by rote. When he speaks, the words are literally unintelligible, although their emotional sense is clear. They are, it seems to her, a kind of answer to that terrible dream which had woken her in the night. Words of soft release and quiet harmony and of forgiveness. The sound of them sends tremors up and down her spine, and they set her skin tingling with something on the very cusp of pain and pleasure. As the Doctor speaks these words, the world seems to change to accommodate them. At impossible speed, clouds gather overhead, the sky darkens, and a sound like thunder is heard from far beneath their feet. The air crackles as if electrified. Moving closer to Polly, without saying anything, and as though it is the most natural thing in the world, Ben slips his hand into hers. She squeezes once. He squeezes back. Seconds later, it ends. The angel seems first to grow faint and then to shimmer slightly before he fades away entirely, leaving in his place only dust and memories and a handful of emerald green feathers.
Doctor?
Ben asks, but before he can say more, in less than a blink, they are all, once again, miles away, back, standing beside the TARDIS doors, as if nothing had happened at all. The Doctor smiles, all impishness again now.
Well, well, he says delightedly, that was really most diverting. Yes, indeed, most diverting. Well, come along, come along.
And he opens the door and he steps inside, and Ben and Polly follow, and they do not speak of this strange interlude, nor do they acknowledge those shifts which have occurred between them, for when they land next, it shall be in a realm of ice and snow, of dead men walking, of cruelty and ambition, and of inevitable change, after which nothing shall ever again be quite as it is now. All of this Polly remembers as she gazes at that curious green feather which has appeared inexplicably here in the family home on this day of all days. So engrossed is she by the sight and by the unexpected tang and vigour of her memories that she has not heard the soft approach of her husband, and it's not until his hands are upon her shoulders that she realises that she's not alone. Morning, Duchess. She reaches up and squeezes his hands. Hello, darling. What you got there, then?
I don't know how it got here, but it reminded me of... Never mind. Oh, Ben.
Hey, what
What's the matter? Her husband walks round, helps her to her feet and into his arms. It's all right, he says. It's all going to be all right.
I was just thinking that I didn't really want to leave here, where we've been so very happy. But then I remembered, and I realised that it is time to move on. It's the right time, don't you think?
Yeah, I do.
It's time to let go,
Ben Jackson nods. Time to fall.
Thank you.
Polly smiles and speaks the oldest and most powerful incantation of all. He replies in kind, I love you too.
Thank you.
Whatever for?
Everything. For all our time together. For being strong. For being kind. For being, well,
for being you. Ben seems about to say something in reply to this, some valedictory words before the business of the day begins in earnest, before the men and their vans arrive and the necessary transformation is set irrevocably in motion. But before he can speak, they both become aware of movement close by, of a flurry of motion, of the manifestation of things which ought not, by rights, to exist any longer in this universe at all. And Mr. and Mrs. Jackson hold each other more tightly as, in a single shining moment, their senses fill up with downy emerald green, as, like confetti, like rain, like joyful tears, there are dozens and dozens of impossible feathers falling and falling all around.